Seems like a full house today. This morning it was so quiet here for Sunday. I thought winter has arrived. Of course, this is the last of this year's reflections. And, of course, the subject is very good to end with, die. Die before you die. And this sounds like a commandment, almost. And it's quite sometimes surprising to me to see how much interest there is in the subject of death, because in a society such as ours, it seems that oftentimes the death itself has been a kind of taboo, a subject that you don't talk about. Nice people, polite people wouldn't discuss in public. And, of course, you have all kinds of euphemisms, ways of talking about it that in ways that don't quite make it so hard or shocking to the mind. But over the past few years, a decade or even longer, there seems to be a kind of willingness to explore this, that it's something that is going to happen to all of us. And we've all experienced in part of our life the death of someone or something, and a favorite pet it could be, or a parent or friend. And then Sogyal Rinpoche's book, the Tibetan book of, what is it, dying? Living and Dying, become a bestseller. And this particular way of die before you die was a kind of phrase that Lumpa Cha, our teacher in Thailand, used. I think partly to shock people, but also as a reflection of say practice, the way of an attitude towards practicing meditation and of living one's life, because the desire to live is such a strong one. And this desire to live is what takes us over and makes us frightened of death. And we live in a realm of times of anxiety and fear, because we see death as such a kind of final thing, that is as if it's a kind of total cutoff, the absolute end of something. And when we contemplate that, or when we think about it, it seems too harsh for us. Just like saying goodbye to somebody you like is you don't want to say goodbye forever, we'll never see each other again. There's always the hope, the lingering hope of see you again. And in every language, you know, there's always this au revoir type of parting phrase, see you again. And not unless we really are in an angry mood and we want to, I hope I never see you again ever. But in terms of what we like, what we love, then when we separate, there's always this lingering statement of, when will we meet again, see you again. And this is, you can see that this life we're living in, this realm, planet Earth, the human body, consciousness itself, is experience of birth and death, of beginning and ending. And so there's always this sense of separation in our lives, the sense of leaving, separating from the loved, is a continuous experience that humans have. And I remember years ago, visiting somebody I knew who had their daughter was only about 3 years old, I think, at the time. She was 3 years old, and we were going to, I went to see he and his wife and his daughter, and then he was going to take me to Sussex University to give a talk. So we were going out the door of the house, he was going to the car, and the father was going to drive me there, and the daughter started screaming, "Don't leave me, don't leave me." I started really getting in a terrible state, passionate state of despair, you know, of grief and loss. Her father was leaving her. And then the mother said, "Oh, he'll be back in an hour," or all the kind of sentences to assuage this grief. But she wasn't at the stage yet where she understood things in terms of the future. No, it didn't. When you realize it, you, after a while, you can reason like that. We say, "Well, I'll see you again in a couple of hours." But say, when you're a very young child, you don't have that perception yet of the future as being anything. All you're experiencing is the loss of the loved in that moment, the separation from the loved. It was like a real strong reflection for me of what it's like, say, for a child is experiencing at that moment this, seeing her father, who she loves, go away, and she doesn't, you know, she thinks it's the actual separation that she's experiencing, the grief of and the loss of a separation of the loved. Then later on, we can always say, "Well, he'll be back in an hour," and we can. So it doesn't matter. We can take it. We can cope with things because I'll see you again next week. Let's set a date. Get out your diary. Can I call you on the phone? Always of keeping in touch so that the separation isn't complete and forever. But death, physical death, has that feeling of separation forever, doesn't it? And then die before you die is to see that, is to begin to allow things to die according to their nature, to let things go rather than to keep hanging on to illusions, to all your desires, all the things that make you feel all right, that make life bearable, but yet still are not really the truth. I mean, we can live in a world of illusions and make our lives quite comfortable just on the surface of making it look pleasant and everything seems all right and everybody's being polite and everything is pleasant and seemingly secure at this moment. And that's sometimes what we want from life. Say, we want each other to kind of say, "Everything's going to be all right. Everything's all right." And we want that kind of affirmation, that, because there's also a part of us that is afraid and anxious that everything isn't going to be all right. So this is something important for us, isn't it? To understand death before you die. Because it's going on all the time in its own way. And when we see it for what it really is, then we realize it's all right. Death is okay. Nothing wrong with it. And that we begin to let go of this anxiety and these illusions of life that blind us and that don't allow us to really experience the profundity and the wisdom that comes with the understanding things as they really are. To see things as they really are is the way of the Dhamma. over this past year, I've been using this phrase from the Majjhima Nikaya that I found particularly meaningful at this time. It seems like in your life, my life as a monk, there's certain things that you read, like in the Pali scriptures. Maybe you've read them many times before, and they're quite all right, but suddenly they jump out at you. You know, they kind of grab you all of a sudden. Things that you may have read many times, but never really noticed that closely. And then suddenly you're reading the same thing again, and it jumps out, grabs you, and then you think, this, I know what it means now. And this phrase, I think I quoted it last week, which is etang amatang. That is the deathless. That is now the deathless anupada jidasa vimoko. That is to say, the release, the complete release, the letting go of the mind, the freedom of the mind, the freedom of the heart, the liberation of the heart through letting go. So this letting go is another kind of powerful Buddhist reflection. Letting go of the death-bound conditions. Letting go is not to get rid of, but to relax, to trust, to relax, to let things be what they are, not always trying to control, manipulate, create things, recreate things, hold on endlessly to things, and then feel only frustrated and angry and bitter when eventually they do leave or they do change in a way that you no longer can have any say about it or control over it. So letting die before you die is a way of letting go of the conditions, a letting go of death, in other words. Letting go of death is an interesting reflection in itself, isn't it? Because that's what we're attached to. Even though we think we're attached to life, we're actually attached to death. Because the condition, like your body is going to die. And so if you're attached, if that's your identity, that's what you think you are, and you invest all your mental conscious experiences with a concern and identity with the human body, where is it taking you? It's taking you to the crematorium, to the grave. And that it's so letting go of the body isn't ignoring it. It's not denying it, but it's relating to it in a different way, changing your attitude towards it, seeing it in terms of what it really is, as a condition that was born, reaches its maturity, ages, and then dies. This is the way it is. So that we, when we understand this, then we aren't creating the illusions of I am this condition that is going to die. Because that's what is frightening to us, isn't it? The thought, I am going to die. Just that way of thinking. Because we are very much emotionally conditioned to think of ourselves as the body. And death then has this sense of finality. If I'm dead, there's nothing. We can't imagine. Or we can imagine. We can imagine states after death of going to heaven or hell, some possible state of permanent bliss or even eternal misery if we've been bad in our lives. Or rebirth, or reincarnation. But we don't know because the body we're living, our experience of life, our memories of life say, for most of us, have been within this form, within the human boundaries of our physical conditioning. So we're living with this human body, and we think, and then we assume that we are this human body. So then the logic that comes, when this body dies, I'll be dead. The same with the mental states of mind, just as the emotional states, the love, the hate, all the different desires of the mind, the positive, negative emotions, the memories, the perceptions of your mind are conditions that arise and cease. And of course they change quite rapidly. In the daytime, you're born and die how many times emotionally? Through just your feeling of life or your memories. You go up, you go down, you become something, you disappear as this or that. You get angry, the anger goes. Greedy, then greed ceases. Get frightened, fear, then fear goes. And you're changing all the time emotionally and perceptually. So that this side of ourselves, we don't, it moves so quickly. Mental conditions are so much more rapid and change so quickly that we don't contemplate them as birth and death. We just see it as we take it for granted that we're just thinking and our moods change. We have different emotions. We're subject to all kinds of conditions in the world. The weather, for example. These past few days have been so beautiful. How could anyone be unhappy when you have weather like this? Yet there are people that manage it, in spite of the weather. And then sometimes you get, here in England, you get these cold, dreary winters. Everything's bleak and rainy and damp. And it's easy to go into negative, to grumbling and complaining, because the mood is one. The things that are impressing on you, that impinge on you, are not pleasing to us, to the senses. So we react in, say, in a negative, grumbling way. And then the sun comes out and we feel happy, and then it goes, disappears, and we feel sad. And so the human society is easily swayed by all kinds of things. We can see in the political parties here in Britain of how politicians want to play on the human emotions, to try to please them, try to inspire them. How to get your vote, how to make you interested, how to convince you, how to sell something to you. Is important in a free market economy. And then there's those that say, well, the truth is the economy is a terrible state, and Britain is, they're always coming out with these terrible kind of facts, like we're behind every other European country in regards to. And it changes. Then you read others that say the opposite. The economy is the best one in Europe. And we go up and down with these different statements. And we get happy and sad and elated and depressed accordingly. So the conditioning of the mind is like that. It's easy. We're born and die how many times a day in that respect? Just the changing mental states, moods of a day. One can look at in terms of birth and death, beginning and ending. So that's an interesting way to start contemplating. How many times are you born and die? do you get born, and how many times do you die in a day? Just to kind of contemplate that, how the mood swings, the changes of elation, depression, high and low can happen. And then the Buddha said to observe the cessation of things, rather than just being seeking the arising conditions, seeking happiness as an end in itself, he said, look at suffering. So he put his teaching, established the essential teaching on the truth of suffering, in order to encourage us to look at that which we don't like and don't want, such as death, or old age, or sickness, or loss of the loved, or boredom, or disappointment, or despair. And you get people coming now, many people who come who have a lot of problems with depression and mental depression. Not because anything's really wrong with their lives, it's not because of great failures, but because, say, the mind gets so wound up and so bound to negativity, to see things always from a negative position, to where the mind becomes obsessed in the state of where, say, a depression is, where no positive thought arises. Nothing positive can kind of uplift you. Your mind is completely bound into a negative conditioning for this period of time. This is what a depression is. And that's a kind of death, isn't it? The death of happiness, where you feel that you'll never be happy ever again, that life will always be this horrible, this bad. And as long as you believe that, as long as you grasp that idea, then of course you will. That's how you'll see it. That's how you'll interpret your experiences. As long as you're bound to that position, and are convinced of that reality, convinced of that as reality, then of course you'll stay in that place until you see that you can let go of it. The death, the letting go of things, isn't depressing, isn't something to dread or to worry about, but to understand, because it's through letting go of conditioning, of the conditions, letting go of the, and conditions are the things that are born and die. By letting go of that, then we realize the etang amatang, this is the deathless. We realize deathlessness. There's a sonnet, Shakespearean sonnet, if I can remember it, that I like. I've reflected on this sonnet for years. Let's see. Poor soul, the center of my sinful earth. Let's see. By these powers that thee array, why dost thou pine within and suffer dearth, painting thy outward walls so costly gay? Why so large cost, having so short a lease, dost thou upon thy fading mansion spend? Shall worms, inheritors of this excess, eat up thy charge? Is this thy body's end? Then, soul, feed thou upon thy servant's loss, and let this pine to aggravate thy store. By terms divine, in selling hours of dross, within be fed, without be rich no more. So shalt thou feed on death that feeds on men, and death once dead, there's no more dying then. So shalt thou feed on death that feeds on men. This is a very, very good reflection for a Buddhist. Isn't it? Because in meditation, that to me is what we're doing. We're actually feeding on death. This means we're really looking at the dying, the loss, the ending, the cessation of things. And this isn't depressing. Depression is holding on to negativity. This is observing, witnessing, examining the ending of things. And this isn't depressing, but where depression is holding on to negative states, not letting them go, not letting them die, but kind of keeping them, obsessing your mind with them, and then you get stuck it's a dead end of the emotions, the pits. But so shalt thou feed on death, it feeds on men, because this is our experience, isn't it? This death is going to take all of us. And death once dead, there's no more dying then. Now this is, I don't know whether Ajahn Chah ever read Shakespeare or not, I doubt it. But I guess this is just natural wisdom. Whether it's in northeast Thailand or in Elizabethan England. But the idea of death once dead, die before you die. There's no more dying then. And so we get back to die before you die. Now I've taken this theme in my life as a Buddhist monk because at first I didn't understand it. When Lung Po Cha first started, when I first heard this and it began to kind of sink in what he was saying, I didn't quite get it, because death to me was very much a physical death. And the idea of dying before you die sounded a bit depressing. Sounded like, as long as you're alive, you might as well enjoy it, have some fun. Why just spend your life, dying when that's going to happen at the end of it, yes, but while you're still alive, you might as well enjoy the beauties, the pleasures of this realm. The more hedonistic approach to life. But that also I found wasn't what really happens. That by trying to hold on to the pleasures of life, you're always creating you're caught up into a kind of frantic search for happiness that in itself makes you feel depressed and bored. That too much happiness, too much excitement gets boring. We have to keep increasing the amounts of excitement in our lives. If that's what we live for, is kind of having exciting, interesting, fascinating experiences, then you can have so many, and then you get weary of it. Then there's a desire to not exist, for oblivion, for just let me just not have to be anymore. Have you ever gone to bed at night just with the intention of just wanting to pass out and not have to be, not have to be conscious? Going to sleep. Sometimes you think, I hope I never wake up. I just fall asleep. Because being conscious again, you have to go through the whole process of getting up, getting dressed, going through all the things of life that can be a bit dreary and boring after a while. Or having to deal with people, with relationships, with the problems of a society, with a family, with a profession. I notice that I have an emotional habit that goes, when life gets a bit unpleasant and difficult on the personal level, there's this thing in me that says, I want to die. It's almost automatic. Even after all these years, I know what it's going to say. If there's any slight little hiccup or problem in regards to to people, and this thing is this kind of habit. It says, "I want to die. I want to get out of this. I don't have to deal with these emotional problems or these fraught situations." But contemplating this, you don't believe it. Where at one time you can actually kind of maybe hang on to that kind of thinking for a while and suffer accordingly by that attachment, through that attachment. But as you see things for what they are, then of course you realize that that's nothing to cultivate, not a state to believe in or to follow in any way. Because the ego, the sense of oneself, this is what is the burden, this is what is the pain of our existence. Being a person, being somebody, having to support and nurture and keep reaffirming an ego is a burdensome thing to have to do. So we can't really enjoy life because as long as we're doing this, because we're always imposing our will, imposing ourselves onto life. We're always projecting outward onto the moments of our life something that isn't real, something false, and we don't even know we're doing it. We're complicating things that aren't really complicated. And so life becomes burdensome. Poor soul, the center of my sinful earth. The sonnet, Shakespearean sonnet. Poor soul, the center of my sinful earth. Something, I forget the next line. Fooled by those rebel powers that thee array. The rebel powers. Why dost thou pine within and suffer dearth, painting thy outward walls so costly gay? Why so large cost, having so short a lease, dost thou upon thy fading mansion spend? Shall worms, inheritors of this excess, eat up thy charge? Is this thy body's end? And this is what our life is about, the ego, isn't it? What we look like, how we appear, our position, what we wear, our profession, our personality, a whole lot is this thing, this external thing. Worms, inheritors of this excess. That's a nice thought, isn't it? We spent all these years trying to make it nice and attractive and so forth, and then worms get it in the end. Well, these are good reflections for the human state, to say let go, to release this, to be free from this tendency of holding, of clutching. And then the words like this I find helpful now, like relinquishment or relaxing. The word relax, I think, is very helpful modern word for people, because there's an intensity to modern life, a stressfulness that people have. They feel it so much now in modern Western life, isn't it? And living in places like London, or you even feel it here. It spreads out into the countryside. This speed, this complication, this complexity, this intensity, this demand, because with the technology and all that, life is increasingly more fast for us. We have time-saving devices that create more work for us. Wouldn't it be nice to just go down and wash your clothes in the stream? They do in Korea. When I was in the nunnery, I took to Sister Vairojana, that Korean bhikkhuni that was with us for several years. In 1990, I went to Korea, and she took me to her convent in the mountains, beautiful place, a really beautiful monastery, and she showed me where the nuns, they're the bhikkhunis, wash their robes in the river, and in the wintertime. And the Korean bhikkhuni robes are the cleanest I've ever seen. They're starched. Everything, you know, remember she always had these kind of very stiff like robes, and they weren't like this, kind of floppy. Kind of material, they're always kind of crisp and almost military-like in their neatness. And so they spend time, the nuns have to, also the bhikkhunis have to cultivate land. They grow rice and things like this. So they use more or less just simple old-fashioned methods of agriculture. And so life in that respect isn't so stressful, because they do the things they have to do to maintain themselves and their lifestyle in a suitable way. But it's not under this pressure of moving rapidly from one thing to the next. This is what is so stressful to the human mind, isn't it? Where you've got so many things to do, and you're continuously going from one thing to the next. You get this burnout, this sense of being burned up, exhausted by this continually going from one thing to the next thing, running around the rat race. So all our time-saving devices have brought other problems to us. And sometimes we long for the old days of where life was a little, where we didn't have time-saving devices. We had to spend time doing things, not just dumping the clothes in the washing machine and then rushing off to do something else. Contemplate this. This is what you know, modern life is this way. Not to say that, I mean, this is what we have now. Life is now for us like this. And it's not to think of it in terms of dwelling on it in a negative, critical way, but to recognize that life is like this, and how can we adapt ourselves? How can we live in this with life as it is, in a way that we aren't being overwhelmed by it, or burnt out, or exhausted, deluded by the conditions that we're experiencing? So one of the things is meditation, isn't it? People now are very interested in sitting still. That's another interesting thing that's happened in the West. Sitting still. Europeans now come and they ask to sit still. Ajahn Veerdhamma is teaching a 10-day meditation retreat where the people come for 10 days to sit still. It's amazing when you think of it. Because they're so used to running around, going from here to there. And then it's a real treat, a real something that is quite precious to have the time, be given the excuse to not have to run around, but just sit still for a while. Be with the breath of your body. Be with the body rather than just making your body do whatever you think, whatever you want to do. Pushing your body, dragging it around, forcing it willfully, manipulating your body with your mind. You're learning how, say, through meditation, to sit still, to let the body be what it is, to learn how to rest with the body, rest in the body. Rather than sit still and try to make your body quiet, that doesn't work, does it, with meditation? You think, you sit down and you say, be quiet, shut up, be still, and you make yourself more tense by imposing your will onto your body, trying to make it do what you want, You can't do it. You become more and more restless and averse. So you learn how to, say, relax, isn't it? How to let go into the body, how to allow the body to kind of calm down, to let it. It can't just calm down with an order right now. And you say, relax and calm down, and the body's just going to go into this nice state of bliss. It takes an attitude, a willingness, a patience, and willingness to be with it with its tensions, with its pain, and willing to bear with those kind of experiences until the body does relax and calm down. Remember, it isn't a mental state, so it takes longer for it. You have to be patient with your body. It takes a longer time for it to relax, to let go of things. And we do. We've created in our lives all kinds of tensions in it. Through experience, through traumas, through just life itself, through the shocks and the pains and the disappointments and the things that happen to a human being, the body gets affected, is affected by those kind of experiences, and it holds on. It gets stuck. It gets blocked with these kind of experiences unless we learn how to relax, how to release, how to let go. So one can see this is also die before you die. Letting the things that have arisen, that affect you, that influence your consciousness, how to let them go, how to let them die. And death, once dead, there's no more dying then. And it's interesting to see when you begin to understand and value this process, how the emotions, say emotionally, one isn't prepared for death. I remember in the early years of monastic life, feeling this sense of dying going on in me. There was emotionally, you're living in a monastery, and you were kind of containing yourself within the limits and the limitations of monastic discipline, and you were conforming to a system. And it brought up all kinds of emotions of negativity, of resistance, of rebelliousness, where you couldn't kind of do what you wanted at the time you wanted to do it. You couldn't follow a lot of strong impulses that you were experiencing. You had to let go of them. You had to just bear with this restless impulsivity. And there's a sense of dying. And I remember emotionally thinking, I'm dying. I'm dying in this monastery. This monastery is killing me. I'm dying. I've got to get out. It's a death trap. Buddhism is about death. Buddha is a demon. The kind of fears of what was actually taking place. The emotional reaction. Panic. But then not believing it and letting go of those reactions allowed for the experience of when something dies, what's left? When you let something go, what is the result of letting go? And so you're observing this, you're noting when you really let go of something. When you really let go of something, then it's like this. It's a sense of, it's like what they call bliss or well-being. It's like relief. Like you're carrying something heavy, and you're sore and tired and exhausted, and then finally you put it down, this heavy burden, and it feels like this sense of relief. And that's what some, I think, some Zen master described as nibbana. The experience of nirvana is like putting down the feeling you have when you put down a heavy object. Contemplate that. Just like putting down something heavy, letting go of something burdensome, heavy and unpleasant, and you put it down. And what does that feel like? Really notice this. What just physically, what it's like. That is a very pleasant experience. And yet we can easily just go on to the next thing. You know, we've got rid of that, let go of that burden, and we've got to create another one. But to notice this letting go and this sense of release and abandonment, you know, say, is a part of the practice, to be able to note that. And to cultivate that way of, say, non-attachment. Anupada jidasa vimoko. The release of the heart, of the mind. The liberation of the heart through complete letting go, through release, through relaxation. So then, just noting little things like that, that sense of relief, without trying to hang on to it, without trying to, it's not something you're going to you don't want, because then if you start hanging on to the idea of relief, you make a burden out of it. But beginning to notice those kind of experiences of life will help you to trust and to develop a way of living in which you are, say, practicing die before you die, this sense of relief, of release, letting go. In terms of Dhamma, then, we're say, what I've been trying to do with these talks, and that is to bring up things of, and kind of contemplate them and point to, say, ordinary experiences. Things that are quite common to any human being in their daily life, but which oftentimes are not noticed because they're common enough. They don't seem important enough. Sometimes we see the religious path or the spiritual journey in such an exalted way, and we make it into something so special, so high, so almost impossible for us, is something in the future, something maybe in the next lifetime, something beyond us. We see our daily lives maybe as obstructions to that. We see, how can I possibly develop if I have to work in an office, or if I have to raise a family, or if I have to, you know, cook for the family, or I have to clean the house, or I have to drive to London every day. How can I possibly spiritually develop anything if this is what my life is about? Because we see maybe Ajahn Sumedho, he lives at Amravati. You can think that only maybe Buddhist monks can do it, and no one else can. I don't know, maybe that's the truth. Maybe you should all become Buddhist monks. But also, don't grasp that, but as an excuse. Because, say, meditation does allow us to, say, begin to notice, to awaken to the life we have. And it's in recognizing, like I'm in my own experience in monastic life, was beginning to awaken or really observe what was taking place. What is relief? What isn't? What is grasping and what is non-grasping of things? And then oftentimes in religious terminologies, you get the enlightenment, the kind of big breakthrough, the grand vision, the big moment where the light blazes and everything is transformed forevermore, is the image of, say, oftentimes we hold on to as what happened to the Buddha. The big enlightenment, the great breakthrough into ultimate truth. And just this way of thinking also puts it into something beyond our daily experience. It's special, it's fantastic, it's exalted way above us. There's no hope for anyone like us. So recognize that the actual teaching, the Buddhist teaching, wasn't about a grand, brilliant enlightenment, but about suffering and the end of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. They're about very simple things, about just the ordinary human experience of suffering and the way of realizing non-suffering. So it's not a teaching that is depends on monasteries, special conditions, special abilities, all the best, and control of environment and so forth. There's the suffering, the causes, the cessation and the path. These are about, say, ordinary human conscious experience. It's about you and me. It's about what we experience all the time as human beings in our daily lives. And so this is why we reflect on this. We take these teachings to bring attention to suffering, the causes, the attachments we have to fears and desires, and the encouragement to let go and to realize non-suffering or cessation of things. Recognizing what it's like to be relaxed, to feel this sense of relief. Like, we do have a marvelous ability to influence our conscious experience. But what we do is I noticed when I first started meditating, I started years ago in Bangkok, and they were teaching me anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath. What I'd do was I'd impose my will on my breath. They say, now watch your breath, concentrate on your breath at the nostrils, breathe in, breathe out. And so then I do this. But I was imposing a kind of willfulness onto the breath. So I'd become agitated, I'd become tense, I'd get headaches. Because I'd sit there and trying to concentrate, and you could probably squeeze, the face would kind of squeeze up like this. What am I doing? But I'm imposing something onto the breath, isn't it? I'm projecting onto the breathing of the body. I'm trying to get something out of it, trying to make it into something that I think they call mindfulness of the breath. And the result of it, of doing that, was, headache. I get these headaches. Because you're bringing so much energy up to your head, up to this part, and you feel that this is a pretty unpleasant thing to have to do. Where, say, if we change the attitude from, say, imposing our will onto the breath to, say, relaxing into the breath, it's a different way of thinking, isn't it? I'm just beginning to notice and relax into the breath, learning to kind of just be with it, to let it be what it is, and to just be with it as a way of training, of reminding ourselves to relax and let go. Then you get very calm. It's a very peaceful thing to do. You feel a sense of peace and well-being. And I remember using the word peace, using the mantra peace, because it helped me to relax. Peace. When I started thinking, I want to get the jhanas, then I go into this state. I want to get samadhi. Then I go into this state of force, because you've got to do this and then do that, and then you've got to develop this and develop that,
it bring up all these habits of force and willpower and pushiness of my mind, which I have plenty of. And so the other way is this sense of relaxing, being with, and also with the body, to begin to, when you, to notice the posture of the body, not as a forceful act of trying to impose your will upon your body, but to just begin to notice, to bring attention to the body, to its posture, to its sensations. Learning to relax with the body, to be with it as it is in the breath, is a way of is the opposite of trying to make yourself get concentrated, or to make your body do something you want it to do. We've had more bad knees and bad backs in the Sangha than you can imagine, through people trying to make their bodies sit in full lotus posture and things like that. Like you read books on yoga and you see Iyengar or something sitting in full lotus. So you wrap your legs up in a knot like that, only to ruin your knees. That's like willing, isn't it? Forcefully kind of pushing, making your body do what you want. And that's not the way. It's not trying to make your body do what you want it to do, but learn how to live with this form, learn how to relax with it, how to abide within its own limitations, respect its limits. It is a limited form. There's only so much you can do with it, make it do, and that's it. And to make it do more than that, unless you want to win gold medal in the Olympics, then maybe you do, but... But most of us don't want to really spend our lives doing things like that, winning gold medals, making our bodies do fantastic feats. After a certain age, you can't do it anyway. So it's time to say, learn how to live with it, abide with it, let it go, let it be, and how to respect it, how to. And how to learn from limitation, from restriction. And then this theme of die before you die. When you let go of conditions, then you realize the realization of the amadasa, edang amadas, amadang. This is the deathless. So death once dead, getting back to Shakespeare, death once dead, there's no more dying then. It's a deathless. So in this way, this is to contemplate and reflect and to realize this yourself. It's not a kind of proclamation of immortality, but it's a suggestion and an encouragement, a way of looking at your life, which will help you to understand and prepare you for whatever happens and the inevitable finality of death of the body that we all will experience in the future. Because if we die before we die, then when the body dies, that's what dies. That's all it goes. Nothing to fear. And that's just a natural thing. It's like anything dying, like a frog dying, or like a anything, you know, that was born and dies. That's its nature. The body, it's doing what it's supposed to do. In other words. And that's all right. Then there's nothing. That's the release. That's the relief. So I offer this as a contemplation for you, final reflection talk on this year. And now it's time for tea, 3 o'clock. Invite you all to have a cup of tea, and then in about 10, 15 minutes we can reassemble those who want to and have any further discussion. Somebody was about how to deal with obsessive mind, where the mind just so kind of compulsive and obsessive with thought and kind of relentlessly critical. And of course, this is something we can all identify with. But with that is a strong desire to get rid of it, to get rid of that kind of mental state. You know, I remember when I first started meditating, the mind was so obsessed with just the kind of thoughts that I didn't like, didn't want. And then there was this kind of willful determination to make it stop, and he couldn't do it. He just the more you imposed your will on your mind, the more hopeless it seemed. And you just you couldn't approach it through willpower, but through relaxing and letting go, just suggestions to the mind, because that's a strong desire. One of the strongest and subtle forms of desire is to want to get rid of something, and it's understandable. One, it's an unpleasant thing to have, and you want to get rid of it. It's certainly, we all understand it, in the desire to get rid of something bad or unpleasant. But that very desire is a strong connection. You're holding yourself to what you hate by hating it, wanting to get rid of it. Like when you really hate somebody, you think about them a lot more than you think about somebody you don't either love or hate. If you're in love with somebody and you really hate somebody, you think about them. Somebody that you neither particularly love all that much or hate, you don't think about. Or if you do, it doesn't bring up any strong feeling. But also, it's a way of training the mind to begin to recognize, for one thing, to trust more in just letting go and relaxing, and letting the mind be that way. I found just by letting my mind kind of go crazy and go on and on and on, and just by allowing it that, then it kind of wears itself out. And you're not that you're trying to let it, you're not saying wear yourself out, commanding it, but just by not making a problem about it and letting it be, and then it, just that alone helps to stop the conditions that create this intensity of this obsessiveness of the mind. Right, but then you know what you're doing. You're not. Once you know what grasping is, then you can grasp things. But what is misery is this obsessive habitual blind grasping of things. That's the suffering. It's always like in Buddhist terms, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. This avicca is the core, is the kind of, is the basic cause. Not understanding things properly, then we create suffering, even with the best of things. Once we understand things as they are, then we can, then we can do what we have to do, but it's done from wisdom rather than from the just obsessive habits and blindness. I remember contemplating years ago, figuring out that if you die before you die, then the ending of things is a kind of death.
It's almost like annihilation.
Well, annihilation is usually like a wanting to get rid of something, like the averse wanting to destroy. Is another attachment. So I mean that's what we tend to do. You can see what happened to the Second World War, to annihilate the enemy. You see, just destroy, kill, murder, and do these kind of acts as a way of getting rid of the enemy or of winning over them. And then the result is you bring that onto yourself. But in letting go of things, then you're not annihilating, you're not destroying out of aversion, but you can let things go, you can let things die. In just terms of mental states, letting things die in you, and then you find once you've understood that, letting the things die in you, then you find that sense of relief, release, yes. Well, that also is to that's part of it, that kind of fading out and being patient with that, because it's a kind of fading process. Things just suddenly just don't disappear. There's a kind of inertia and a period of kind of restlessness or anxiety, and just keep kind of accepting, bearing with that, enduring that, and then that will go. And then it's like annihilation is where you deliberately get rid of something, and that tends to be like repressing something. It's not you're still, it's like you're holding it down, looking the other way, still there, but you're it's not in your consciousness because you're rejecting it. But this way is allowing grief and despair into consciousness and letting them go, not getting rid of them. And then they go, and then there's a peace that comes, a natural state of the purity of the mind. Like it's more like the true nature of mind is pure and bright. It's not conditioned. It's not anxiety. It's not worry. It's not an emotional state, but when we forget that, then we tend to create all kinds of conditions in the mind. Like we do, we become obsessed with thoughts and ideas, And then we have no refuge outside of just going from one thing to the next. It's like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, you know, that state of where there's no self. And then once you develop an ego, then you, like, you're thrown out of that state of bliss, and you're in this realm where everything is just survival and ups and downs and so forth, and you feel alienated and frightened by being out into the cold, cruel world with the tigers and the sharks and all the rest. And then through that, then the suffering of that state, we develop wisdom. And then wisdom, they bring us back to that realization, that purity of the true nature of things. That comes from that purity of the mind. That's how we relate and how we live our lives. That's the flow of, and the way to respond to life through that purity of the heart. You see, and then so that we're talking maybe about die before you die. And death once dead, there's no more dying then. Then there's still living form. You know, you still, human beings still have eyes, and you're still conventionally a person. But you're letting go of the illusions that you create. So then how you respond to life is in a loving way or compassionate way. Because that's a natural way to respond when there's no self kind of influencing, no fear, no desire influencing consciousness. So that's why, say, religion talks about love, and it's as the way, or God is love. Things like this are also, you know, good reflections, but love also is a word that gets used for lust and greed and all kinds of things. So, but then taking love to, say, unconditional love or purity, the purity of the mind, then it's this way, say, the way we relate from the mind that isn't bound into selfish delusions. It's like you say, love, we say two people fall in love with each other, and then they start quarreling and fighting because they make demands on each other. You see, so in those moments, there's no love there. If when you're making endless demands, possessive, jealous, things on somebody else, there's no love in that itself. There might be actual love, has happened in the sense of the initial sense of union or oneness with somebody else. But then, without wisdom, we go into the state of demanding and possessing and creating endless problems about each other. And then the love is not there. There's kind of possessiveness maybe, or need, or and that, but not love in that pure state. So then it becomes, it becomes complicated and difficult. But even, but there was, a pure state. It wasn't just a delusion. But then how wisely do we respond to that kind of situation? You know, and if we haven't learned from life, and we're still operating from immature emotions, and that, then we tend to create complications, demands, selfish demands on somebody else. Well, that's the way it seems, isn't it? I mean, we're individual beings, and it seems like I am a person. I mean, the way I think, I have a passport, I have a birth certificate. My mother told me I'm a person, and the society confirms it, and. It's Ajahn Sumedho's personality. And people, you know, this is a conventional reality of how things appear. Just for example, to the average person, you don't need to think of the world as round, do you? If you're going from here to London, you can operate on the assumption it's flat. That's the way it looks to me. When I go to London, it looks flat, doesn't look round. Because, and I can still get to London just as fast by thinking it's flat as thinking it's round. In fact, maps are all flat. You know, you don't take a globe with you. It's a kind of A to Z in a round form. So you can... See that on the conventional level, there is a self, there is a personality, and it can be good, it can be sometimes good, it can be really horrible, it can be sometimes good, sometimes horrible, sometimes mediocre. I mean, we're all kinds of things, you know, and it varies according to circumstances on the personal level. But what we're pointing to is not to when we identify with the personality, and we never question it. We're merely acting out the roles and the habits of our that we've developed. Then we never develop anything other more than just then reinforce. These delusions that I am this thing. When we actually examine it, we see personality as something changing. It comes and goes. You're not a person all the time, like a permanent person. The sense of you being a person comes and goes. And through mindfulness, you begin to notice when there isn't any person and when there is. That's the question the Buddha refused to answer. He really did. I'm not joking. Eh? Cuz you don't know that. Probably we've all met many times. Back in Rome, back in Egypt. At least I feel that we're not, that it's an ongoing process where we are meeting it's a difficult thing to explain because just the way the mind's conditioned to think about it is such a kind of starkly kind of personal approach. Like I am Ajahn Sumedho, and I'm in a previous life I was Ajahn Sumedho with a different name. things like that. Or I was a Belgian nun in a previous life. Somebody read my aura and they said I was a Belgian nun in a previous life. And so I thought, that's nice, isn't it? I've got a strong monastic inclination. But I don't remember that. I have no kind of memories, or even the hearing that doesn't kind of ring any bells in my mind, bring up anything that I could say is a deja vu or a recollection of a past life. But it's more like these things are such changing conditions, like this word like archetype kind of psychological types, men, the mother, the father, the king, the queen, and so forth, of various roles, role models, and archetypes through history that are common to all human societies in one way or another, the priest and the sage and so forth. And these you can feel also an identity with. Sometimes you feel you can feel an inclination to maybe one over the other. I remember a book came out a few years ago that some of the nuns were reading about the goddesses, the Greek goddesses, and interesting how some would identify more with Aphrodite or with Hera or with Athena. they could read the descriptions of these different kind of female archetypes and then feel more kind of inclined to one than to the other. And what is that, you know? Is it just a fantasy life, or is there affinity or more kind of sense of commonality with certain things, or with astrology, you know, to study the different signs and the way we can identify with these particular things, different aspects of human behavior. But in the long run, we've probably been through the whole range, the whole gamut. And in Buddhist cosmology, for example, I remember Buddhadasa Bhikkhu in Suan Mok, who died last year. He presented the Buddhist cosmology, the six realms of existence, in terms of emotional states rather than kind of realms, external realms. And I found that interesting way to contemplate just what a deva, a kind of angelic or celestial being, is like. And say, in my own mind, or what a devil is like. And so, you know, when you can say, like, devas or these kind of celestial beings are refined states. They're beautiful. There's no coarseness. They play music, and they're light and radiant, and they delight in a very high level of refined aesthetic refinement. And I can see that also, the beauty, say, of aesthetic refinement and music and light and that is, you know, not coarse, not crude. And then you can also, because I have mental states where the mind is in that realm, you know, where it doesn't stay there for very long, but it certainly have had refined mental states. And then you think of the asuras, the kind of jealous gods, these kind of jealous warrior gods that are always fighting, and they're kind of big and strong, and they're green colored because they're jealous. They're usually colored green, and then they're very powerful figures, and they really jealous of these devas, these celestial beings. So they're always having war in the Buddhist cosmology. They're always fighting, having battles with the devas. These asuras and the devas, the ongoing battles. Because the jealous gods, they've got the intelligence and that, but they live in this realm of jealousy, always wanting, you know, envying, feeling that the refinement, beauty, the celestial radiance of these devas is something that they want to get. And you can see that in yourself, the kind of the ambitious side of yourself, the jealous god, that wants to get something and get on top, get above the those that are seem to be better off. I mean, one can identify, one can see those tendencies in various emotions that one has. But also, you're contemplating them not in terms of personal, of identity with the personal, saying, I'm a Rinashura, or I'm a celestial being, or I'm more of this and less of that. You're seeing that the whole range of human experience, like the human state, has such a wide range of experience, from these radiant celestial states through to the most hideous, hellish emotional states of just wanting to destroy, torture, humiliate some beings, you know, where you can get into demonic states, where mental states of just wanting to hurt, harm, maliciously harm and humiliate others. You know, this we can see this in the news. You hear about these things, human behavior. I mean, people they call human beings who actually act on some of these on they say demonic impressions of the mind. So that's why it's important to tune in to, say, a moral standard, a standard of where you refuse to do things that are harmful. Otherwise, we would tend to, you know, if we have no standard for a kind of moral responsibility for ourselves, then we can be pulled into all these different levels of action and experience. And you can see, I've contemplated, just like you, these dreadful kind of serial killers and that do things like this boy that would attack old women and kill them to get their pensions, and he would stomped on an old woman, left his heel prints in her face, and it's for a, you know, why would make an 18-year-old boy do something like that? And you can say it was because his mother died when he was young, or you can try to do it sociologically, but a lot of people's mothers die when they're young. We don't all do that. But I mean, there's a connection maybe to that kind of demonic energy. You know, if you're not given a standard, some kind of moral position and confidence and integrity, then you would easily get pulled into these, into say, very harmful actions. And they had a few years ago, the BBC made a very interesting video. This was in 1988. They made a video on called The Return to My Lai, which is, My Lai was a Vietnamese village that in 1968, 20 years before this film was made, the American, maybe you remember, the American company went in and just slaughtered, brutally slaughtered and killed everything in sight, including, you know, men, women, children, water buffaloes, dogs, cats, the whole thing. Just in a state of total kind of demonic possession of and fear, they went in and brutalized a whole village. And so the BBC, this was such a shock to the American public because this was one of kind of really shocking things to Americans, because the American image was that American GIs would never do anything like that. American soldiers were like John Wayne. You go in and you get rid of the commies, and you save the old women and the children from the brutal enemy. But in this case, it was the brutes were the Americans, and it was a really powerful shock. So then, when the BBC made this film, they interviewed Vietnamese people who survived it, what it was like 20 years later in 1988, and they also interviewed American GIs who were still alive, who'd been involved in that. And it was interesting to see that the difference between a man that was just pulled into this demonic action. Like, you can understand, it was a frightening situation. You're told, you're kind of conditioned through military life to kill. You know, you're programmed to fight and to kill, and then you're told that the enemy is surrounding this place. Don't trust anyone. Anything could be the one that's going to kill you. So you're psychologically all kind of wired up with fear and just self-survival, and thrown into this scene, and you also feel that people don't like you anyway, because that was one of the things that Vietnamese didn't like, the Americans, and so they weren't wanted there, even when they were thought they were trying to help them, and so. Then they started, just one little thing would set them off. They'd just start killing anything. But there was one man that didn't do this. There's several, and they interviewed. One was a black man from Alabama who said he knew killing was wrong. God didn't want us to do it. It was an evil thing to do, so he wasn't going to do it. And so he went in, and he refused to kill anyone. And so they interviewed him in this TV film, and it was, and he was working in some factory in Alabama, and he seemed pretty, you know, that was 20 years before, but he seemed like a man that had lived his life well. He had some kind of integrity, something in him that wasn't, couldn't get deluded by the fears of the rest or the propaganda. See, that's somebody who's taken on a responsibility for his life. And of course, 20 years later, he wasn't frightened. He seemed to be well-adjusted, you know, man, living his life in a good way. Another man was another black man who had become involved and killed many people, and he was just, you know, he was sitting there, this table of medicines in front of him, and he's just shaking, you know, and frightened. And he said all he could think about were the faces of the people that he'd murdered. And they come in, they haunt him all the time. And he's tried to kill himself many times, and even he was, his own son was killed before him in some way, I forget, but I mean, his whole life, he's just frightened, and he said, by the time this film is produced, I'll probably be dead, because he obviously, you know, was trying to kill himself. It's too unbearable, the memories of what he'd done, and the ghosts, the things that come back and haunt you. So, I mean, I thought it was a really good Dharma reflection of karma, what happens when we do things like that, and when we don't do things, when we do develop integrity and a sense of honor of how we're going to live our lives, then we can say we can learn from life. Doesn't mean we're always going to be right or that, but we do have something to come from, some center of stability that we don't have if we're just thrown around into these different realms by circumstances. And if you have no center, no inner core, then you're just like a leaf in a...